Turn your radio on.
This is a download from Triple J.
Australia's national youth network. On radio,
on TV,
and online.
For more music, current affairs, comedy, and culture,
triplej.net.au.
And now...
Hello, Carl.
Good morning. How are you today?
Very well.
Isn't life good?
Life is amazing.
Do you ever feel one of those days where you think, I wouldn't be dead for quids, and it's the school holidays?
Life is a good place to be.
Yes.
Life is a good place to be hanging out in. We're talking science over the next 50 minutes or so. If you've got a question for us, I can actually see four lines free right now. 1-300-055-36 if you've got a question for Carl. Of course, if you've got any answers and you can't get through, you can tweet them at DOCTORKARL, or you can hit us up on the Triple J forum, triplej.net.au. There's a dedicated thread. 1975 7555 is the text line if you want to text in your answers. So many ways to get in contact. But, of course, we are only taking calls from you for questions, like Stuart in Alice Springs. Hi, Stuart.
Hi. Hello.
What's your question for Dr. Carl?
First, can I say hello to Dr. Carl?
Hello, Dr. Stewart. Look, I'm so happy to see you, and I'll be going out to Alice Springs in a couple of months. I'm going to take my family to see the desert park. I love Alice Springs. Have you been to Alice Springs?
10 years. Yeah, 10 years ago, I was in Alice Springs.
Yeah, and you notice that.
But of course, Triple J was just in Alice Springs a couple of weekends ago for the one night stand.
That's right. And you know when you go into Alice Springs, there's that little mountain range about 100 meters high, the McDonald Ranges, mate. They used to be taller than Mount Everest 130 million years ago. And it just gives you an idea of the antiquity of Australia, where you have so much old stuff that's been exposed for such a long time. And you get Europeans coming to Australia and they say, it's all crap. I want to see real mountains. All you got is this rubble. And they're right in one sense, but on the other hand, the rubble itself is the antiquity. And the thing is that near Alice Springs is the world's oldest continuously operated mine, 400 centuries, 40,000 years. The Aborigines have been digging ochre to use 1,000 miles each side of Alice Springs as currency and as a colouring agent. And your question was, Dr. Stewart from Alice Springs?
Yes, Stuart. What was your science question for Dr. Carl?
It's about dinosaurs. Are there any known examples of surviving trilobites today?
What are trilobites, Dr. Carl?
Trilobites are a creature that popped up about 540 million years ago-ish in the Precambrian explosion. So basically you had single-celled creatures from about 3.5, 3.8 billion years ago until 600 million years ago. And then suddenly, in this Cambrian, named after Cambridge, explosion, suddenly all sorts of life happened and nature just erupted. Oxygen levels were climbing for the first time. The oxygen levels on the planet had been between 2 and 0% all the way through from 3.8 billion years ago until about 500-600 million years ago, and then they started to climb. And all these life forms came along, and trilobites, you see them as a fossil, and they got three sort of symmetrical things to them, and they died out in a Great Permian explosion, Great Permian extinction, 250 million years ago when, in Siberia, massive volcanoes happened over a period of 600,000 years, a million years, covering an area bigger than the USA or Australia, to a depth of 1 kilometre of lava. And now it's down to about the area of Europe, about 2 million square kilometres. And your question is, are there any trilobites still around?
Don't know.
Don't know.
Well, it'd be hard for them because you couldn't just have mummy and daddy trilobite giving birth to a boy and a girl trilobite, which in turn became mummy and daddy. You need a large surviving colony of them. And
you couldn't have like a Noah's Ark sort of scenario of trilobites.
Well, you could. They're in the ocean, and we know less about the ocean floor than we do about the distant stars. It's not impossible that there could be an enclave 100 metres by 100 metres.
But nothing's been found yet.
Nothing's been found yet.
All right. Thanks for the call, Stuart.
Thanks.
See you later. Thank you. Grace is calling in from Armidale. Hi, Grace.
Hello. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning, Dr. Grace. How old are you?
I'm 24.
Well, you are my new best friend forever.
What's your question, Grace?
My friend Portia and I were conducting an experiment when you put salt on our arms, then ice over the salt, and it really hurt. So we're wondering why it hurt.
You did an experiment?
Yes.
Did you write down stuff?
Yes.
Do you take photographs?
No, we didn't get around to that.
But there's two of you there.
There's two people on the phone. I'm confused. Or is Grace two-headed? Is there two people on the phone, Grace?
It's me and my friend.
Oh, okay, cool.
Well, by the way, my friend and I, you almost lost a point there. What happens is you're looking at a thing called osmotic action.
Oh.
Okay, so if you get some, this is old person talk, cellophane.
Yeah.
You've heard of cellophane?
Cellophane still exists, doesn't it?
It does. You can buy it in news agencies. And what you'll do is you get some blue tack and you get a little pot or a bowl and you just make a barrier, a wall of cellophane, waterproof wall of cellophane, and you put water on each side and the water goes to the same level and you tip salt in one side. And the level that the salt is in gets higher and higher. And so the salt mucks up. So what's happening is the salt is interfering with the fluid going into everything's been opened in the cut. How did you make the cut? Was it accidental? You didn't do it deliberately, did you?
No.
Good, good. That was the right answer. You're getting close to winning a Triple J fun pack. And then the nerves for pain, which were only discovered in the last 10 years or so, started to swell. And this made him send signals to your brain saying, ouch, 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 ouch.
Okay.
Now, I know you're 24, but if you happen to be school-age kids in the school holidays, you could win $10,000 by making a 1 to 3 minute video. Just look up Sleek Geeks and Eureka, E-U-R-E-K-A, and Adam Spencer and I are trying to give away $10,000, but you have to get in there and make your 1 to 3 minute video by the 7th of May. So it's basically the pain is due to osmotic action, I think, causing water to rush into the pain nerves and make them swell, I think.
Thanks for the call, Grace.
Okay.
Thank you,
see
Dr.
you
Grace,
later.
And Grace's best friend.
On to our cousins.
And sorry?
We'll pass the video on to our cousins.
Sweet.
Yes, make them do it.
Give a shout out to our brothers.
Hello, brothers.
Yeah, Grace, we're going to let you go now, mate. Yeah,
we love you.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Dr. Grace, and a
Grace.
Best friend forever.
Phone hog. Julian in Miranda. Hello.
Hello, Julian in Miranda.
Good morning, doctors.
Good morning. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
I picked up it's called a mobile phone anti-radiation patch, and it's like a little sticker that's, I think it's made out of gold. It's in Chinese, so what it actually does is a bit hard to, I can't understand it, but I think I understand it's meant to reduce the electromagnetic radiation from a mobile phone.
And where are you supposed to put this patch? Is the patch the size of the palm of your hand or a postage stamp or your fingernail?
Oh, I'd say about the same size as a postage stamp.
And where are you supposed to put it?
You're meant to put it on the phone.
Which part of the phone?
Oh, on the battery or on the back of it.
What if you put it where the antenna is not?
I'm not sure. It doesn't really go into that detail. But I just want to know.
How much did it cost?
$8.
They didn't rob you very much then.
You don't think it works?
No. Look, if you really, really, really want to make an anti-radiation thing for your phone, go to the hardware store and buy some fly screen made not of plastic but of metal, you know, the bronzy sort of stuff, and wrap it around your phone.
Right.
And apart from the fact that this thing called a Faraday cage stops your phone from working at all, it does have the effect that it has guaranteed that you won't get any radiation from your phone. Now, the question is, so it stops your phone from working. The Faraday cage stops any radiation getting in or out. Now, is there any proof that the radiation from phones hurts people? We don't know. We've been doing it for, what, how long, 10 years? How long have digital phones been around, 10?
Probably about 12? 10 years at least.
Yeah. Look, it might be like tobacco and you need a 30-year lead time, but at this stage there's zero proof.
But the anti-radiation pack doesn't work, Dr.
Nah.
All right. Thanks for the call, Julian.
Put it on your forehead and go to a party or something.
Really?
Yeah, well, I don't know what sort of wild, crazy parties you go to.
I don't know what kind of parties you go to. Stuart in Canberra, hi.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Carl. Been a long-time fan. Just wondering, with autumn now coming into swing, how do trees know when it's time to lose their leaves?
The reason that they lose their leaves and go autumny, rusty brown is that chlorophyll, the greenish chemical, is expensive to make metabolically, and they suck it back. They don't want to throw it away. They suck it back into their trunk-like substance. And how do they know? They have a clock that monitors the outside world. Now, you might think that being a tree, you've got a fairly low IQ, but trees are actually quite clever. They, firstly, don't have legs, so they've evolved whole bunches of chemicals to fight off invaders. They've worked off communication methods, so that if you're a tree at one end of a field and you get attacked by a fungus or a bunch of insects, trees at the other end of the field will start manufacturing the same chemical to fight off. And they have a way to monitor the length of the day. Now, if it was an animal, it's quite straightforward, be almost certainly something to do with the pineal gland. I don't know where the clock is, where the clock of life is that monitors the length of the day, and I off the top of my head, but it'd be really easy to find out. But they've got some sort of clock, and I don't know what their sensor is. It could simply be the amount of sunlight that falls on them. If it's greater as opposed to lesser, then they do this and they assume that that's equal to the length of the day. But they've got a clock.
Makes sense, Stuart?
It does. So why do some trees turn red and others leaves turn yellow?
It all depends on how much chlorophyll they call back. And when I say chlorophyll and photosynthesis, there's not just one type of photosynthesis. It turns out that there's hundreds of different types of photosynthesis. And now they reckon it's gone into quantum effects. So you have one single photon. Just imagine you've got one photon of light hitting a leaf. And I was just reading this fascinating paper which implied that there's 20 different molecules going down different pathways saying, me, me, me. And that one photon of light appears to all of them at the same time, even though it can only be in one place at one time. It uses the quantum effect where you can be everywhere in the universe at the same time, and it talks to all 20 molecules, and then all 20, even though it can only talk to one, but it talks to all 20, and then it goes down the most efficient pathway. Freaky, man.
Hey, thanks for the call, Stuart.
Great, thank you.
See you later. Ben's calling in from Hornsby. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Zan. Hi, Dr. Carr.
Dr. Ben, love your work.
You've got a great question.
Yeah. I'm a carpenter, and myself and the guys that we work with all wanted to know what happens to all the wood dust and the brick dust and concrete dust that we breathe in each day. How does our body get rid of it?
There's a thing called a mucociliary ladder. Ladder, like the one you climb up and down on. And if you're a Sparky, it's made of fiberglass, not metal.
Yep.
Ciliary, they're little hairs on the cells in your airways. So beginning at the top of your throat and going down into your lungs, and I think a couple of generations of division of cells. What happens is the air comes down into your airways, it continually comes to forks where it divides and divides. And I think there's something like 20 or 30, maybe 28, I seem to remember, generations of dividing before the air, which hopefully by this stage is totally purified, comes up against a wet membrane which has blood on the other side. And that's where the gas exchange happens. But you don't want it to be clogged up with dust. So in the first couple of generations of splitting, at the back of your throat and into your lungs, there's these hairs called cilia, and they're covered with a mucus. So that's your mucociliary ladder. And what they do is they pick up the dust and then they move it upwards. And several times a day, you'll go like this and you'll swallow the dust. And some of the dust will go into your gut. Sometimes you'll spit it out, but most of the time it goes into your gut. And I remember on one occasion, there was this guy who, a patient of mine, who had this terrible, terrible pain in his gut, and he just looked wasted. And I said, have you been losing weight recently? And he said, yeah. And so I went through the whole history, and I worked out that at one stage, during one of the many 17 wars that Australia's been in, he was involved in putting asbestos on pipes on warships.
Okay.
And he said, and the dust was terrible. I just kept on swallowing it.
Yeah.
And blow me down, he'd actually had a sort of mesothelioma and asbestos disease of his gut. So the dust that you swallow is caught by the mucociliary ladder, moved upwards, and several times a day you go, and you swallow it into your gut. And so then it comes out through your bum.
Okay. Is there any that stays in there and turns nasty? Or?
If it's very small dust, it'll stay there forever because it's gone past the mucociliary ladder. And that's the worry with some of the nanoparticles that we're working with today or generating in the environment or in the big cities. We're making the diesel vehicles cleaner, but they're making smaller dust particles which go deeper into your lungs. Everything's got side effects. But the vast majority, as a chippy, the vast majority of the dust that goes in your airways comes out through your bum.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Ben.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Dr.
See you
Ben.
Later.
Thanks,
Tony's calling in from Bathurst. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how you going?
Good. What's your question?
Yeah, look, I've been wondering about long rivers, say like the Nile River.
Mm-hmm.
Are they long enough? Like, do they flow around the curve of the earth? Like, you know, the Nile rises somewhere in Tanzania and goes to Egypt. It's, I can understand them flowing downhill, but from my understanding, Egypt's around the curvature of the earth from Tanzania, not strictly downhill.
Yeah.
Or is it not long enough to be affected by the curvature of the earth?
I think the earth drops, for every 5 kilometres across, it drops... Look, if there's a surveyor, can you tell us? I seem to think that it's about 4 metres. For every 5 kilometres across, the curve of the earth is 4 metres. But that's not the the important thing. The important thing is distance from the centre of the earth, right?
Yeah.
And it's going to keep on flowing, so it keeps on getting closer to the centre of the earth. Now, to get 1 centimetre closer, it might have to flow 100 metres acrosswise. But at all stages, it's doing that. Now, the earth spins... and it bulges slightly at the equator.
Yep.
And so as a result, the mountain on Earth, which reaches furthest away from the centre of the Earth, is not Everest.
It's somewhere on the equator, like Kilimanjaro.
Mount Chimborazo,
right, yeah.
Which is actually lesser height above sea level, but it's further from the centre of the Earth. But the thing that's driving the all rivers is that they want to get closer to the centre of the Earth, and so they'll flow horizontally in whatever direction is necessary at a slight slope. And then you've got to factor in the fact that the Earth bulges a little bit at the middle. Jupiter, because it spins so fast and so big, bulges by 10%. The Earth is, I don't know, a fraction of a percent. I can't remember the exact number. But that's what drives them.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Tony.
Thank you,
Dr. Tony.
Nicole in Ballarat. Good morning.
Hi. How you going, guys?
Good.
Hi, Dr. Nicole. Welcome.
What's your gassy question for us?
My question is, I'm a mum of a 7-month-old boy, and even when I didn't have my own child, I found when I was burping the baby, and I've asked other parents, I burp too. And I haven't been a windy person. So I'm just wondering if there's a scientific reason behind that.
Is it,
or if it's more psychological.
I mean, we always get the question about why do people yawn when they see their friends or family, just other people yawn. It's like that makes you want to yawn.
Mm.
And your answer to that, Dr. Carl, is that it's empathy, that basically it's you empathising with someone else. Could it be the same thing relating to, you know, burping, that you're empathising with the baby and therefore you're wanting to burp as well?
Yes. Normally with burping, the cause is mostly swallowed air.
Mm.
And if you're going to be burping, you'll have a few little burps here and there during the day. And maybe, I don't know, I haven't read the paper on this, your theory is correct. You have a baby who's burping, you want to empathise with the burping. And I'd like to point out the woman I work with, Miss Pegram, she did all of the burps for, who was that gross man who saved the world?
big fat
Australian actor, Barry Humphries. He
saved the world.
He has he plays the part of an actor who, one of his characters is a really gross, Ross Patterson, no?
Les Patterson.
Les Patterson.
Barry Humphries.
She did all the burps for that.
Wow.
She can burp the alphabet. But
so it could be empathy.
I'm going with the empathy theory, bearing in mind that it happens only when you're burping the baby.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah. I've got no good answer, and if anybody could give us an answer, please Twitter at us on Dr. Carl,
okay.
D-O-C-T-O-R-K-A-R-L.
Keep listening. We'll see if we can get any more about that.
Great
Thanks
question.
For the call, Nicole.
All right, thank you.
See you later.
See ya.
Rigo's calling in from Ringwood. Hi, Rigo.
How you doing, guys?
Good. What's your question?
I just wanted to know, I recently had a flight to Fiji, and at 30,000 feet, the ears become pressurized, and then I had my iPod on at 70% volume, but by the time I reached 30,000 feet, I had trouble hearing it because my ears were pressurized, so I had to turn it up to 100%. I was wanting to know, if my ears are pressurized, can they sustain damage?
Ah, language warning for the next 1 minute. Okay, switch off the phone, everybody, or the radio who doesn't want to listen to this next bit. This fits in with a question that happened about 2 years ago where a woman rang in and said, language warning, whenever I have oral sex with my husband and his penis hits the back of my throat, I go temporarily deaf, Dr. Carl, and when I ask my girlfriends to do this, and they all did it, and it happens to them too. Why? So something's hitting the back of the throat, and at the back of the throat you've got the eustachian tubes. and they lead up to the eardrum. And they can block and put a preload on the eardrum. The eardrum is incredibly floppy. The latest figures I have, that when you're listening to the quietest noise that you can hear, your eardrum moves a distance equal to the diameter of a hydrogen atom. I used to say a tenth of a diameter of a hydrogen atom. I'm now saying a hydrogen atom, which is still very, very small. And if you've got an ear blockage with the Eustachian tube thingy, then you're putting a preload on this incredibly floppy, incredibly sensitive thing. So you need to put in more noise to make it respond.
Mm.
So I'm thinking that's what happened. Was it on one side or both sides?
Both sides. I just had to turn it up louder to hear it at the same level.
The trouble is you can run into hearing damage.
But if
you suddenly came good, it would suddenly pop, but that wouldn't really matter. Normally it happens on the way down rather than the way up. You had it happening on the way up.
Oh, and the way down. Like even when in descent, they were still... I have trouble releasing the pressure in my ears. So that's
the cause of it. The fact that your eardrums are not as floppy or compliant as normal, and therefore you need to shove more energy at them to make them work.
Okay, fair enough.
Thanks for the call,
Rigo.
Thank you, Dr. Rigo. See you later.
Bye.
Just earlier, before that song, we were talking about where dust and, wood dust and the like goes if you inhale it. There was a carpenter who called in before. Pauline Blackburn's got a follow-up to that. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. What's going on with you?
About 6 weeks ago, I had cancer surgery to remove a adenocarcinoma from my frontal sinus.
Inside your frontal sinus?
That's right, yes.
How did you diagnose it? What were the symptoms?
Luckily for me, the tumour actually grew in a spot that blocked the sinus off, and so then I got a build-up of yuck, mucusy stuff, whatever, and it caused headaches. Generally, they grow up there until, it's possibly too late, but I just fortunately got mine growing in a good spot.
Did they do the surgery from inside?
They sort of cut above my hairline from ear to ear and pulled everything down and cut the front of my forehead out and then cleaned out the sinus and et cetera and then put the skull back on or the front there, the forehead
the
back
scalp.
On.
And what's your prognosis, your future outcome, your life expectancy?
Fine. Yeah, it's all good, I believe. In another week I start radiotherapy. But the surgeon said that it was a timber-related cancer.
A timber-related cancer? Tell me more.
I don't know too much about it, but they said that this type of cancer, adenocarcinoma, the particular one was related to timber or timber dust. And I was just wondering where I got it from. I did do furniture design and industrial design, which was related to timber a bit, but they said it's a slow-growing cancer, and I didn't do the furniture design long enough ago for it to manifest, to what it was.
So apparently, in the act of breathing, some of the timber dust must have gone not just through your normal airways, but actually taken a detour and up into that closed cavity that has only one way in or out, one of the frontal sinuses above your eyebrows, and then sat there and festered and set off some sort of reaction. Did they say, the surgeons, that this happens with regular timber, or does it have to be timber dust that's arsenic or covered in some sort of horrible hydrocarbon, or is it just regular old dust, or is it oak is more likely than cedar or the other way around? Do they give you any hints like that?
They only said, I think one surgeon said it was related to hardwood, but that's the only thing that I got as far as any of the glues, et cetera. They didn't really say anything about that.
Well, look, I'll go looking this up, and look, I'm glad you're well, and look, I'm just warning you, look, radiotherapy sucks. you just sit there and the machine goes hum and nothing happens, and 5 hours later you're vomiting and you feel like you're dead and you want to vomit. Mate, deepest sympathy with you, and I hope you can get through the radiotherapy okay.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Good luck, Paul.
Good
thanks
luck,
for
Paul.
The call.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Slade's calling in from Toowoomba this morning. Hi, Slade.
Hi, Dr. Slade.
Hello, doctors. How are you?
Very good, Dr. Slade.
My question is basically how does one-way glass work?
And can you use one-way glass to trap light?
Ah, you are a deep thinker, grasshopper. No, you can't. There is no such thing as one-way glass. It's impossible, even though various dictionaries claim that it is. I wrote about this in my 23rd book. And the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language defines a one-way mirror as a mirror that is reflective on one side and transparent on the other. Ah, that's impossible, often used in surveillance. It is totally impossible because if you have a mirror, if you have a lump of glass that lets through light in one direction only, well, obviously you just get your bits of one-way glass and you make a six-sided box. Yep. And then light flows into the box and it can't get out again. And the box is just full of energy. Then you make a little tiny hole and let the energy out and you use it to power an aircraft carrier for 5 years. And then you block up the hole again and then the box magically fills up with energy again without having to do any work. This is creating energy out of nothing. This is impossible. This is against the laws of thermodynamics. It is totally impossible. And it's totally due to the fabulous salaries that the actors get in TV. The way you think about a one-way mirror is... think of two rooms next to each other, but think of sound. Don't think of light, think of sound. And one room has got some people playing really loud music, and the other one has got two people whispering to each other. Well, the people who are whispering to each other can hear each other and can hear the music. But in the room that's full of loud music, they can't hear the people whispering. And it's the same sort of situation. You have glass, which is called half-silvered glass. So it's not totally transparent and it's not a total mirror. It's halfway in between. And if the light levels are the same, think back to the sound levels, if the light levels are the same, you can just see somebody through the other side. And if you make the light levels very different, well, then you can see in one direction but not the other. But in the movies, how come you can see the hero in a well-lit room? Well, the hero is getting $40 per movie, which works out to $500,000 per minute. And they're not going to have him standing in the dark for a whole 30 seconds.
$40 or $40 million?
$40 million, I lied. Okay, they're not paying him $40, $40 million. And so they want to get the audience value for money, so they light up the room. So if you ever see the cops doing the surveillance thing, providing they're standing in total darkness... that's okay. And they're lit only by the light coming in through the glass. That's okay. But at the moment there's a light in the room, forget it. The whole thing's impossible.
Impossible.
Impossible. Totally impossible.
Or impossible. Hey, does that make sense, Slade?
It does. Thank you very much.
No worries.
Thank you, Dr. Slade.
Thanks for the call. We're talking science for just a little while longer. We've got time for just a few more questions. Sian from Campbelltown, good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
I've just got a question that's been puzzling me for a couple of years since I've had kids, actually. Why is it when you hold a baby in your arms and they're awake, as soon as they drop off to sleep, they feel heavier? You're completely suspending all of their weight in your arms. Why is it when they go to sleep they feel heavier?
It's like that dead weight, isn't it, when you're trying to carry a sleeping body?
Yeah.
I thought about this as we walked across Spain, briefly carrying, until we came to our senses, the big, heavy packs on our backs until we put them into a taxi and send them across Spain at 30 euros a day, so that was 1,000 euros. Money well spent for the seven of us, I thought, and a human being as well. I don't know. If you have a backpack and you mount it firmly on your back and then you tighten up the waist strap and it's mounted on your shoulders and there's the right ratio of weight on your shoulders to your waist to your hips, it's much lighter than if you're trying to just have it hanging loosely on your back. And once again, that's lighter than trying to carry it in one hand.
Yes.
So is it as simple as that, that the baby, when it's alert, is supporting his weight, and so not supporting his weight, but supporting its structure. So all you're doing is holding the baby by his or her hips or under the armpits. But when they go floppy, their head falls on you, the legs fall on you. Is it as simple as that? Have I explained it? I feel as though I don't have a good answer.
The reason why I'm asking you, we went to the Easter show yesterday and walked around all day with, you know, the baby backpacks and had a 15-month-old baby in the backpack, and you can tell the moment she falls asleep.
I've had that too. See, that's the thing why I don't like my explanation, because the entire weight of the baby is not felt by you at all. It's felt by the structural integrity that makes up the baby backpack or front pack, which then goes onto your shoulders and hips. And yet when the baby goes floppy, it feels, the weight feels different. They feel heavier. I do not understand what's going on.
No.
Now, I tell you who might know. the military, because they're in the business of having poor soldiers carrying huge weights over long distances. And if there's somebody in the military who can give us an answer on Twitter, I'd be ever so thrilled. And by the way, the military in America have come up with a thing called the Dog, which is a four-legged robot that can carry 200 kilograms. It's basically a platform with four legs.
That's it.
That's just Dr. Carl giving you something extra.
The point is that they're thinking about this. They're trying to work out it. They'd be the people who'd probably know more about it than most other people, even more than the so-called backpack companies and the expeditioning companies, the military.
Thanks for the call, Sian.
Okay, see you.
See you later. Tom in Brisbane, good morning.
Hey, my question was, I was reading about a little while ago that people think that possibly life on Earth came from out of space. From like an asteroid dumping basic amino acids and proteins and that. So I was thinking, if you flew off to a really far away planet and dumped something there from Earth, do you think if you then sped it up by about 3 billion years or something, then the bit of rubbish that you left there could have created life on another planet?
Well, firstly, in first year university, when I was doing medicine, we had an hour-long discussion about what is life. And we were pretty sure that a crystal is not alive, that a bacterium is alive, and a virus is sort of halfway in between. So what you want is, as a definition of life, something that can make copies of itself, that can make more of whatever it is. Right. And so you're saying what you need to have life are the bare minimum of three things: the right raw materials, which are probably hydrocarbons, chemicals with hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon. You need a power supply, which can be a nearby sun dumping out heat, or maybe a planet like Jupiter or Saturn dumping lots of radiation onto its moons. That counts as an energy supply. And finally, you need the three states of matter, solid, liquid, and gas, because the difference between the moon and us is that on Earth you've got the three states of matter, solid, liquid, and gas, and on the moon you don't. It's all solid. So I can eat some corn, breathe out carbon dioxide, and it floats around through the air and then goes into another bit of food which I eat, and so the life cycle goes on. I'm pretty sure that there's life on Titan. There's a wonderful article in the recent Scientific American about it, and there's sand dunes on Mars, which are almost on Titan, which are almost identical to the ones in the Namibian deserts or the Sahara. But getting back to the life, you've got to at some stage go from your raw amino acids into a way of making more amino acids. And does that mean some sort of DNA type thing?
Okay, so
where do you do that jump?
It could possibly lead to life on another planet by dumping something from Earth.
Yes, I am quietly confident that something like that could happen. I'm pretty sure it happened on Earth, but how do you do the steps? It's just part of the stuff that we don't know as of 2010.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Tom.
That's a big one, Dr. Tom.
Tom's blowing our mind in the last 10 minutes of the show.
Yeah, where did that come from? Yeah,
Emily in Glen Waverley. Hello.
Hello.
You've got a cute little question.
Yeah, it's a lot less profound than your last question.
We travel all scientific journeys in Science Hour. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
Well, I'm not sure if it's just me or anyone else. I've never asked anyone else this question. But ever since I can remember, my pinky toe nails and my fingernails grow faster than the rest.
So the little toenails and the little fingernails grow faster than the rest of your nails on your hands and feet?
Yeah, not freakishly so, but just a little bit, yeah.
How do you monitor this? By when you have to clip them with the fingernail cutters, toenail cutters, you think, gee, that little bugger's longer than the one next to it. Is that how you do it?
That's right.
Look, really, I'm sorry to do this to you, but you've got to do the experiment to get a free fun pack from Triple J, which involves getting from a hardware store a triangular file.
Okay.
Then file an ever so gentle nick on each of your nails where the lunule, you know, the little white bit, if you're looking at your fingernails, where the white bit joins the coloured bit.
Okay.
And then do that on a certain date. And then measure it.
Okay.
And then get back to us.
All right, then.
Now, look, this is to cover up the fact that I haven't got a good answer, but and most of me believes you. 99% of me believes that your self-reported observation about yourself is correct, but we want numbers. But now let's try and give an answer. What do you reckon, Dr. Zan?
Well, I sort of thought that maybe with the little toenails, because it's such a small nail, it looks like it's growing more.
Oh, it looks bigger.
Because it's such a tiny nail, whereas, you know, your big toe is a massive nail, so you don't notice the change in nail length as much. Same with, I guess, the thumbs. That's my theory.
I thought that too, and I also noticed that it's thinner than the rest, so maybe it's just making up for it. You know?
But if you want to go for the length,
yep,
get that little triangle or a nail file and just make that ever so small, Nick, and write it down in a bit of paper. Okay. If you want to get the Triple J fun pack.
Let us know how you go, Emily. Thanks for the call.
We're talking about a month or so, Emily.
Yep.
We want to have a return phone call from you.
Okay, sure.
He's serious.
I am serious.
Hey, we've got time for one more really quick one from India. Hi, India.
Hi, India.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
A friend and I were sitting on a veranda one night and there was a really big flash of light that we both saw. We're out in the middle of nowhere. There's no neighbours or anything. And the next day in the paper, it said there'd been a sonic boom from a jet ages away that had shaken houses in our area. And I was wondering if they could be related or what else it could have been.
It might... I don't know. number one, I was thinking of a meteor flash. Number two, any ideas? No. Sonic boom. Maybe there was some sort of bioluminescence in creatures around you. Like in America, you got the fireflies, and I've seen fireflies in Australia.
No, it was big. It was like lightning, but there was no storms around, like sheet lightning sort of thing.
Where are the military who are going to call back and tell us about the answer on that one?
Maybe they'll tweet you, Dr. Carl. Keep an eye on Dr. Carl's Twitter, DOCTORKARL. If those answers do come through, I'm sure Dr. Carl will retweet them for everybody following in. So we'll see if we can find out for you. Hopefully we'll be able to get an answer for you. Thanks for the call, India.
Thank you, India, and we love you because you said a friend and I, not a friend and me. We love you for that.
Dr. Carl, we will see you next Thursday morning at 11 a.m. Don't forget you can catch up with the podcast, triplej.net.au, every damn week. It's up there shortly after midday.